Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of MTG Rants. I'm Tannen Grace, and as always, you know, Ross and Miriam. Ross, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Always fun to have March Madness. We're recording this, you know, shortly after the games have started.
What's in bigger shambles, your bracket or your Magic game?
Okay, we're only two games into... We're about to finish the second game of March Madness. I am about to lose a Sweet 16 team, so not great.
So maybe your bracket.
But I got the first game right, so we're doing better than last year.
So we're 50%, okay.
Yeah, 50% is better than last year by quite a margin. So, and man, I literally made this change to have BYU as a second round upset to win. Like, it was the last change I made, like last night, just on a whim. I was like, what if I just had like one more upset in the second round? Like one more two seed losing early. Yeah. I'm like, you look at your bracket and you're like, it just looks a little too chalky. I'm like, well, let's just pick one. And the analytics liked BYU or whatever. So, but they're of course losing to Duquesne. But I like March Madness as an event. I used to be like super serious with my bracket and like spend all week looking at it. Now I spend like, you know, an hour doing it and have some fun with it. But it's just such a fun tournament. It's like, because there's so many people that play college sports that are never going to play professional sports, and they know that. Mm-hmm. So tournaments like this are a huge highlight for a lot of them.
For some of them, it's like a
showcase to try to go pro or whatever. Yeah. But for a lot of them, like, this is the highlight of their athletic career before they have to, like, go into real life and, you know, become a pickup player at their local YMCA. And there's always, like, you know, six or seven, you know, big upsets, and you know, you're not really sure when they're going to happen, but you're flipping through games, trying to find the go-to ones and great endings. So it's one of my favorite sports events of the year, even though I think college basketball on the whole is a garbage product that I cannot imagine watching an entire season of.
Yeah, not a big fan. Believe it or not, I'm not that big a fan of college sports. So, like, overall, I like, you know, I like baseball. I like college baseball, not as much as I like MLB. But I think it has to do with, you know, my school being a dynasty almost my entire lifetime, which helps a lot. And then, obviously, I like college football. My school has been good most of my life. They were pretty bad, you know, until I was in, like, high school or whatever. But they're really good. They put a quality product out there. Their team is really good. They put a lot of NFL players out there. The games are fun to watch. Like, I'll admit, that's fun to do. But, like, I can't follow it with the same gusto and interest that I can, like, the major league sports. Yeah.
The actual quality of play is so much lower.
I mean, don't get me wrong. They're good. They're good sports. Yeah. They're super entertaining. I prefer college football to the NFL.
No.
I do.
College football is oof.
I mean, the NFL is oof.
So because the quality of play is so much worse, the thing that I enjoy is like fun storylines and like David versus Goliath stories. And March Madness as an event produces a ton of those.
Sure.
Every other college sport is like college baseball. I think the College World Series, you can have like a big run through it, but you usually play like a multiple game series. They play like best of three or best of five, something like that. So that reduces variance. And with college football, you don't get even a chance to, you know, as a huge underdog to play for a national title. No other sport would allow St. Peter's to be in the quarterfinals of the national championship as like the 90th best team in the country. You just wouldn't even get that opportunity. So the March Madness just ratchets up the variance, which helps to compensate for the lack of skill.
Yeah, I mean, you can play the I think basketball is the most conducive to having a tournament structure. Like football, you can't play often enough. Baseball, you need to play more than one game in a lot of instances, even though they do actually do like an approximation of it. You know, they do like a similar type thing, but yeah. Anyway, we're into too deep into that. Speaking of sports, did you know baseball technically started yesterday? There's been two games already,
like spring training games.
No. Like actual major league baseball games. There have been two, and
they played in like Japan?
They were played in Korea.
Oh, close enough.
Yeah. So San Diego and the Dodgers played yesterday and today. The game started at like 4 a.m. I think your time, 5 a.m. my time, something along those lines. So they play two games. Here's the weird part. They're going to fly back to America, which, I mean, they might already be on their planes. I don't know what their schedule is. And they're going to re-enter the spring training stuff and play games for fun again. you know, not real games, and then start up when everybody else starts up, like a week from today. So for everybody at home, today's the 21st. It's 2 p.m. my time on Thursday, March 21st. We're a week away from the regular season. Also, we've got our first big drama in sports. I'm not going to go into this.
So
go ahead.
So Major League Baseball just schedules some like actual games to be played internationally, like every league does now, because they're trying to open up these markets. And obviously, like, you know,
it's been very successful in baseball, by the way.
Korea, Japan, you know, very big baseball countries.
They pick the two correct teams as well. Like the Dodgers have, you know, Yamamoto and Shohei Ohtani. And the Padres signed like multiple people from Korea and like in that league this year. So like they had a whole bunch of like hometown favorites and stuff.
But presumably they have to do it before the season so that you have time to fly back and you're not completely destroyed for whatever you play next. So they just have to play early. That's why.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. It's not unreasonable.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, football has games in London and stuff. Baseball either plays in like Mexico City. You know, there's been some other stuff, blah, blah, blah. But one of my favorite things was Yoshinobu Yamamoto made his first start today. The guy that signed the biggest pitching contract in history without ever throwing a pitch in the major leagues or the minors. You know, he's played in Japan all the time. Like, let's get this right. He's been the best pitcher in Japan for a while now. He's extremely young, so I got such a big one. He lasted one inning today, gave up five runs. I still think the kid is going to be dynamic and very good, but there's the part of me that, you know, that hates the Dodgers and just looks at it and kind of laughs and enjoys in the, you know, when you have like a rival or like a team that, like, you can put it this way. I know you get this and a lot of people listen. If you're not a Yankees fan, you're everyone likes to root against your team.
Yes.
Like everyone just hates the Yankees, or, you know, that
as they
like,
should.
Yeah, there's no middle ground on the Yankees. You know what I mean? Like, you love them or you hate them, right?
I became a Red Sox fan mainly out of my hatred of the Yankees. The fans were just so annoying. I was
they're
like, you know, I don't necessarily care about rooting for local teams.
Yeah.
And I just said, fuck it. I'm going to root for the Red Sox because I want you assholes to lose.
It's technically a local team for you, though, with where you grew up and everything.
Like, yes. Oh, yeah.
Are they physically the closest team to where you grew up? I don't know the geography.
Yeah, technically Boston is slightly closer to us than New York. It's very close.
Sure.
Our school, like my schools growing up, it was always split. You know, it was half New York fans, half Yankees fans. Basically, if you imagine Connecticut, which is roughly rectangular in shape.
Ross, I just want you to know, I try to never imagine Connecticut, just but you can continue.
You can draw a diagonal line from the northwest corner to the southeast corner, and the Boston side of that line is more Boston fans, and the New York side of that line is more New York fans. And I grew up along the line.
Okay.
But when I tell people I'm a Red Sox fan, they're usually not surprised because I'm from New England. But I'm not a Red Sox fan because I'm from New England. I'm a Red Sox fan because Yankees fans are so fucking annoying, I couldn't take it. And I just wanted to channel my bloodlust into something more productive.
I feel really bad for any fan of our show that's listening around that's a Yankee fan. Like, I love you. I want you to know that I love you as a fan.
I don't love you. I hate you.
But it comes to baseball, we're going to make fun of your team. All right.
Continue making your point.
I forgot where I was going. But anyway, I mean, like, at this point, we're so far gone from the original point. I don't know if we can get it back.
You're talking about how fans are going to hate your team, and you accept that. You embrace the hate when you're a front runner fan.
I don't know if that's exactly where I was going, but sure.
But you were really just trying to introduce the Yamamoto scandal, which is very weird.
No. I think it's funny. Like, there's that vindictive, petty side of me that is happy that he got blown up in his first start.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Dodgers spent over $1 billion this offseason on players.
Well,
that's what the B.
They promised $1 billion.
Sure.
That apparently they just get to pay whenever the hell they feel like.
Yeah. They're like, we'll pay you sometime, right? And, like, I'm not going to get into the specifics of this because it's not for the show or whatever, but, like, I don't know if you've heard about the scandal that's going on with Shohei right now. It is wild.
Oh, yeah, not Yamamoto. Yeah, Shohei's, I didn't read into it, but I, you know, saw the headlines.
I've made a lot of jokes about it. I made this joke yesterday. I was like, so when Shohei quits baseball for 2 years to go play in the NBA, I think we know actually what happened this time. If anybody's an MJ fan, they'll really get this reference, and it's really funny. For the 5% they get it, this is a good one. For the other 95, sorry about that. But I joked about they should let Shohei hit leadoff in their next game and just swap their first and second hitters because Mookie hit second. So their lineup literally start with Shohei Betts.
Yeah.
Get it?
Because
he's getting in trouble for legal gambling and stuff, and betting on games. And it's not funny when I have to explain it, Ross. A lot of people would literally say Ohtani bets.
Wait, hold on. I thought the scandal was his translator was doing weird stuff.
So no one knows what's really going on. So the initial story is that like his translator had like maybe like in bet, like his translator was $4.5 million in debt for gambling or something like that, right? And the initial story is like it's his money. Shohei felt bad for his friend and like paid it off, right?
This is the translator's story.
Yeah, he felt bad for his friend, the translator. Yeah. I don't know if you can hear this. Sorry, someone. It sounds like someone has a weed eater right outside my window. I don't know if this is being picked up on the mic. It is extremely loud. I apologize if y'all can hear this.
For the first time, I can actually hear it, but it's okay, not that.
It is. I feel like it is in the room with me right now. But
it almost sounded like it was starting to rain where you were. Yes. And you're like under a tin roof.
No, I think there's a person literally outside my window. Anyway, I'm gonna go over this real quick because like we're still getting the news and sorry everybody, but so translator is like $4.5 million in debt. Apparently, Shohei's like, I want to help my friend out. I'll pay off the debt because Shohei's worth just bajillions of dollars.
Yeah,
and then they find out like that's not legal. You can't really do that. Like this is you can get in trouble for this. So the next day they've walked everything back and they're like, no, wait. Shohei didn't pay off anything, and so. After the game, the news comes out that
I don't know.
There's something illegal. I don't know, dude. I'm not a cop. There's like all the stuff going on. Then after the game, the story changes, and they're like, no. Shohei had nothing to do with this. He didn't know anything about it. The guy stole the money. Like he's actually a thief now.
Yeah, that's what I had heard.
So now we're saying he's a thief, and like all this stuff. So now he's been fired. And Shohei had nothing to do with this, and it's all in this guy. This guy's like, yeah, I have a crippling gambling addiction, like stood in front of the team and said everything to them. When if you watch the game that like is an hour before this, him and Shohei are just like hamming it up in the dugout, like acting like normal people when you're about to like have this guy get. So there's like a lot of people think that like maybe Shohei has the betting problem here, and this guy's like, he's falling on a sword, however you want to say it, you know, like blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just going to be a giant mess, and whatever's going to happen at the end of it is nothing's going to happen to Shohei. Like, he's just going to get away with anything that he did actually do here, if he did anything.
Yeah, sorry, this is going to be a Ray Lewis situation, though not quite as serious.
Yeah, and my favorite is like the double standard here, too. Since he doesn't have a translator now, they're like not making him talk to anybody, so that's an obvious like okay thing. Like the press just can't talk to him.
I can't face the press. Yeah, I don't have a translator.
Yeah, right? And I love this because last year the best player of the Atlanta Braves, Ronald Acuña Jr., got shit on in the press because after we lost in the playoffs, he was like, I don't feel like talking to the press after the game, which happens to players all the time.
Yeah,
and they were just like, no, he's a piece of shit. He has to face the music, like blah blah blah. You can't just get away with this. Like, blah, blah. And then they always say this stuff like, oh, he's living in America. Why doesn't he just learn English so he can do his own interviews and stuff? And I'm like, where are those people now for the white guy? You know, like, I don't know. It's just, it's really annoying to me. But, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's all stupid. And no one's going to get in trouble because they're rich and they get preferential treatment.
I guess, like, paying off your friend's gambling debts is still, like, makes it look like you might be gambling.
The thing is, apparently this has been a big investigation since, like, January.
Yeah.
And, like, other shit's going on. I've heard reports like ESPN looked into this and found the $4.5 million or whatever. Then they found two other bets that were $500K a piece that literally have the word Shohei Ohtani in them, in the book or whatever. And the bookie, who they're saying like, oh no, he did this just to drum up like extra people to help him out. But the bookie used to tell people, yeah, I take bets from Shohei Ohtani or whatever, whoever the money went through. I'm just calling it a bookie because I don't. You hear different reports from different things all the time now, and it's really hard to find someone that just sums up all of it in a TLDR. You get what I'm saying? Like, you get pieces here or there because of the way that news is reported nowadays. But yeah. So like, again, we probably shouldn't even like. I didn't really want to go into this or whatever. Wanted to do the show, but
can I?
Crazy. Yeah, go ahead. Of course.
I just want to say it's ridiculous to me that the leagues are still going to be this ornery about betting. Like, we went through the whole Calvin Ridley thing recently in the NFL too, when every one of these leagues is now partnering with online casinos.
Oh yeah, it's really funny. Keep doing your point. I'm gonna find this tweet that like sums up that if I can real quick. I'm gonna look for it. Keep summing up your point or whatever you're gonna say, because it's ridiculous.
Just rank
honestly.
Hypocrisy.
Yeah, like the tweet was. I'm gonna try to summarize it. It was like. It's like, hi, I'm blah, 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 reporting for ESPN, brought to you by FanDuel. today on the news segment brought to you by Ultimate Bet, and then it's just like this brought to you by betting. This, and it's like Shohei Ohtani has a betting scandal next to him. How could this happen? And it's just it's sponsored by four different gambling websites. You know, it's just like it's on everything that we do now. It's shoved in your face because it's legalized across the entire country now. And like, it's like I think I told you this. Like when I did my small little bit of like sports radio, I got into it right when this started getting big, and they like forced us to talk about sports betting all the time. I'm like, I'd rather just talk about the sport. I don't want to talk about the, okay, so like, let's talk about the Dodgers-Padres game, right? If we had 10 minutes to talk about it, 7 of it would be about the line and who we think is the favorite and why, like, you know, like, it, and you make all these, well, you know what I mean? Like, it's like the typical stuff when you watch it on TV nowadays. And I'm like, but we're not actually making any points here about the actual games. We're just talking about where you should put the money. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. Some of it's cool. I'm just not a big sports bettor.
Yeah, I don't care about sports betting.
I do have my sports bet lock of the year for baseball this year, brought to you by Ultimate Bet. #actually not actually sponsored. If you want your sports bet of the year, like if you want to put one down to have a sweat.
What is it?
Spencer Strider in El Cy Young. Lock it up.
Okay.
Just give him the trophy already.
Sure. There might be a little bias there.
Yeah,
so maybe.
But he's also. I think he's also the betting favorite. But I still think you should bet on him because I do think he's going to win. Anyway, we have a show today where we're going to talk a little bit about what happened over the weekend. Just for a moment, I went to the Hunter Burton Memorial Open. Great show, great cause, and then I think we'll finish it off with a little bit more of the flashback episode because we're still waiting for all the stuff that should happen. And I think we were hoping it was going to be this week. I think it's going to be next week for a bunch of the previews of the new set.
Yeah, for Thunder Junction. So. Got one more flashback before we
Thunder
get into
Junction,
that.
It does not sound like a magic set to me. It sounds like a ride at Disneyland. Like I've been in line for 3 hours for Thunder Junction, man.
Should have fast passed.
I know.
The fast pass line is 4 hours.
I remember when I went with my ex-wife, we were at one of the ones. We would do the single riders lines. That was the play, man. You just walk because like you get on the same ride half the time anyway.
Yeah.
Or like you know you just get on the ride, you go and you're like okay because like you know if we would go just us two like. We don't want to just stand there in line for a billion hours.
Do you know what the actual play is, Tannen?
What's that?
To not go.
That's also a... Well, when it's like, when you're in the area anyway, and it's free, you go.
Okay. That is true. The one time I've been to Disneyland, it was free. And I've been to Disney World on a couple of school field trips.
Which one's which again?
Land is California. World is the big one in Florida.
I've been to Disneyland once. Disney World a bajillion times.
And I've not been since I was 18. I went to Disney World twice in high school and Disneyland my freshman year of college. And then my friends had such a good time that they went back every year. And every year I was like, God, no, I do not want to go there.
Yeah.
And I stayed behind it.
A lot of it's miserable. Some of it's actually pretty great. Like some of the rides are fun. It's like whatever. It's cool bonding time with your friends. But like the lines are miserable. Like there's so many people. Like,
yeah, it's just so many
I don't like
people
parades,
and
so,
so
I definitely
much
don't like
walking
this.
And yeah. So much shit I do not care about.
The walking,
I don't understand
I don't
Disney
mind.
Adults. I don't yeah. get it. Like, you know, I don't think I've... And I personally don't think I've watched a Disney movie in like a decade. I'm like, sure, like watch them. But the people that are like really, really into it...
Yeah. I technically watch a lot of Disney
out.
Stuff. That's because I like Marvel.
Yeah, yeah. Like that. So. That's, I mean, like, you know, Disney branded, you know, G animated movies.
Sure.
Like,
I know what you actually mean. That's kind of why
I'm if you're
quite...
fucking, you know, dressing up as Elsa to go to Disney World at age 36.
Hey. Look, man, let them like what they want, dude. Oof. I get it. You're a hater, but let them like
I
what
am.
They want here.
I absolutely will not let people like things.
Speaking of this stuff, I was flipping through the TV last night to find some stuff to watch, and. Did you watch the X-Men cartoon growing up?
I did.
You know, da-na-na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah.
So the new one came out yesterday, and I watched the first two episodes, and it's great. This is called X-Men 97. It literally picks off right where they left off the show.
Did you watch the YouTube videos of dubbed X-Men animated series? It's where we got the meme, I'm the Juggernaut.
No.
Yeah. Oh. they were something.
Well, I mean, it was apparently so popular it got into the actual movie. So let's talk about some magic, man. Let's
okay.
stop this.
You went to the Hunter Burton Memorial Open this weekend to do some commentary.
So it was great. I did a tiny bit of commentary, a little bit of coverage, like doing, you know, all the other stuff. Very laid back atmosphere, very awesome tournament. You can tell everybody there is having a real, it's like, you know, when you go to a tournament and the vibes are just better than other ones, like people are like happier, you know what I mean? It's like a little less serious. Not saying the serious is bad, but like, yeah, it doesn't have that, like, no one's having fun feeling, you know, everyone's taking it super serious. Like, if you're a poker player or a Magic player, you can tell, you know what I'm talking about. When you go to, like, the Pro Tour or, like, a big-time poker tournament, everyone's, like, quiet and serious and, like, there's no laughing. There's no fun. Like, we're here to be serious, you know? And that's not the feeling you get when you're there. Also, there was, like, Flesh and Blood going on, Lakata. I think there's another game, too. Tons of other games. Lots of cool stuff going on. Silent auctions. All this money was going to suicide prevention. Just a great cause. And I just had a blast. Honestly, it was really great. Got to watch some great Magic, some great players. I got to hang out with, like, Aspiring Spike. Brent Wagner, our editor, was there. We got to hang out quite a bit. He got a feature match, so you can go back and watch him play. Tons of stuff. I love Brent to death, but boy, is he hard to cover. I've covered him multiple times now. Have you ever seen his decks before?
Are they foiled?
They're foil awesome art and, like, the weirdest art possible and everything. And he's also just, like, playing Amulet. He always plays, like, the really weird off the beaten path decks, or he plays the most complicated deck possible, pretty much. And it's all alternate art. Like half his cards are like the, what do they call it? The double feature, you know, the really dark stuff. All his basics, I'm just like, it's just a black cube. I'm like, I don't know what that is. That could be a mountain. It could be a forest. I don't know. It could be an Uno reverse card. It could be anything, Ross.
It really could be. Nobody knows.
I love you, Brent. But yeah, just a great time overall the entire weekend. I'm still a little tired from all the traveling, man. I, like, drove up there, did the show, drove home, and it just took a lot out of me, man. Like,
You're old.
I mean, I'm going to be 40 this year, Ross.
Jesus.
I know, right? Some people ask me that when we're there. They're like, you know, like, how old are you? I was like, oh, I'm like 39. I'm going to be 40 this year. And, like, it hits you sometimes. You're like, man, I'm kind of old. You know?
40 is... That's real. Like, you start to feel old in your 30s, but you know you're not old yet.
Yeah.
And then when you're 40, it's like, okay, this isn't a joke anymore.
Because in my mind, I'm like 25.
You know, yes. And
like, yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
And yeah, I stopped like updating my mental image of myself at 25.
Sure.
And that's where I am. I still have a full head of hair.
Sure. Same.
So, yeah. I don't get hangovers. It's great. Everything's fine.
Yeah, I have a six pack from being skinny, like, but not the real one. Yeah.
Well, like, I never had that.
well, yeah, I used to be extremely skinny, Ross. I used to weigh about 30 pounds less than this. So.
See, I turned 25 in 2013, so I was 25 during 2014, and that was a good year for me. That was the year I went first, second, and some opens, and made the PC, and started playing more GPs and hit silver for the first time.
If we're gonna make a trek down memory lane, why don't we just go ahead and pick up on the flashback episode here?
Yeah, we're not quite to that part of our careers. We left off at Pro Tour Philadelphia. This one in particular being the first modern Pro Tour. So this is summer of 2011,
right? And so, this is the one where, like, all hell kind of broke loose, right? Like,
So essentially, what had happened was, Extended had been a bit of a shit show for a while, and once he tried to fix it by reducing the number of sets in it, it basically became like what Standard is now. You know, bigger than what Standard was, but not by much. So they basically, like, forced a big rotation and shrunk the format in order to get rid of Thopter Depths, which had been dominant for too long.
Let's talk about this too. Like, Modern was kind... So this is my memory of it. Modern was kind of... It started as a, like, community-based format that people were playing on Magic Online. I think Gavin Verhey was pushing it really hard. And there had been some, like, community started tournaments of it, and the reason it was called Modern,
theirs, I think, was Onslaught Forward.
I don't remember exactly right.
I think theirs was Onslaught Forward.
I'm not 100% on that, because if I remember right, the reason they called it Modern, and that maybe that's when they switched this and to call it Modern, because maybe they had a different name from it, was because it starts with the first set that had the Modern facing.
Yeah, and that is why they call it Modern. So that it started and ended up starting with 8th edition, which was the core set released after Onslaught Block. So, but I believe the Gavin Verhey led format included Onslaught Block. So this was a year less of sets.
Yeah, another cool little tidbit for people who might not know this. This is one of the reasons why we have some weird cards in Modern, because in 8th edition, Anybody like me who's a Blood Moon hater, back then we got to vote on cards that were going to make it into the core set, and Blood Moon beat out, what was it, Dwarven Miner?
Dwarven Miner, yeah.
Yeah, it beat out Dwarven Miner. So we could have had a format with no Blood Moon in it, but instead... Yeah.
For like five of the cards in the set, WotC would put a pair of similar cards.
And you'd vote.
There was Birds of Paradise versus Llanowar Elves. Mm-hmm. There was a Vine Trellis versus Utopia Sprawl. I think those were actually bunched together. So it was like... Utopia Tree. So it was Llanowar and Utopia Tree versus Birds and Vine Trellis.
Sure. I thought it was Birds and Utopia Tree or whatever, but whatever.
No, because they didn't give us both multicolor fixers.
Sure.
The vote went Vine Trellis.
Uh-huh.
So we lost Llanowar Elves in the core set for the first time. Yeah. I think Ensnaring Bridge might have gotten in that way too, but I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure that's all Ensnaring Bridge got in.
Yeah. Rewind versus Dismiss was definitely one of them. I was really mad at the time when Rewind won. Rewind's probably better these days. But back then, card advantage was so king that Dismiss was better.
I'm a big fan of Rewind, by the way.
Yeah, Rewind's fun. But yeah, that's how the crappy cards got into 8th. But Extended was kind of a miserable format. And we had
not good.
The previous Extended PTQ season got completely dominated by Cobblade.
So yeah, the turnout was really low.
Yeah, by the end of the season, you were getting like 60 people for PTQs, which was very small.
I went to a PTQ where I think my final record was like 2-2-1, or something like that, with the draw being like unintentional early, and I easily top aided. Or something like that, I think it was like 14 people or something, or 16 people, or 18 people or something. And I was like, this is not good. That's like...
Yeah, it was bad. So Extended was clearly had a problem, and like that, even banning WotC, I guess, decided that like even making bans wasn't really going to save it. So they effectively replaced Extended with Modern. Now, this Pro Tour, when it was initially announced, was announced as an Extended Pro Tour. There was always one Extended, one Block, and one Standard.
In the simpler days.
And I had a friend of mine from Connecticut that I was going to test with for this Pro Tour, and we started it was Cobblade and fairies was also good in this format, and we started testing that night. We just played Cobblade against fairies, like tried out different builds, and you know, after a few hours we were like, Cobblade is way better. It turns out sort of Feast of Famine letting you attack through all the fairy tokens for Bitter Blossom was a big deal and making your creatures invulnerable to their removal. So yeah, so we realized like Cobblade was just going to be completely dominant. We're like, okay, I guess we're both playing Cobblade, and we'll start, you know, working on the best list tomorrow. And they made the announcement, of course, at midnight, because this is back in the day when all the websites used to update at midnight. And so we like just got done testing. We tested from like, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock to about midnight, and then we just saw the announcement. They're like, we're creating this new format. This Pro Tour that's in 3 or 4 weeks is the new format. Here's the ban list. Here's the rules. Good luck. And we were like, well, fuck. I guess we've got to try to learn a whole new format. And I spent, you know, I went to the GP the week before in Pittsburgh, and then, you know, went over to Philly afterwards that Monday and got a hotel for the week. And I was also testing with Matt Marr, who's a Pro Tour player at the time. And so I stayed with him. And my friend from Connecticut wasn't going to be able to get in until later, so he was just kind of like, you know, teleconferencing in. And at the end of the week, we also had like a powwow with some Minnesota players. And so Matt and I were basically testing alone for the week, and we were using the Magic Online data as our metagame guide, like what was doing well in the daily events. This is before leagues. So you just had daily events, and there were 4 rounds, and we were looking at what was going 4-0 and 3-1, and we were like, use the most popular decks as like our gauntlet, and we were trying to build against them. And of course, those decks were terrible. Like, it was like a really crappy version of like a ramp deck with Cloud Posts and stuff, but it didn't have any of the busted cards. Like, the versions of this deck that ended up being good played Through the Breach and Amulet, and you know, would just like turn 3 the Emrakul every game. And our, like, the versions we were playing against were like turn 4, turn 5-ing it. And so we just built an Affinity deck because we figured, like, Affinity's got a bunch of powerful cards. That deck's busted. And, like, we're beating those decks, and we're beating some of the reactive decks that people were playing that were also bad. But our Affinity deck was like a turn 4 deck. that like at its best would turn three. So we were like slightly faster than the bad decks that everybody was playing online. And so we thought our deck was great. We're like, we found a fast deck that's like also resilient to these interactive decks, and we're going to be good. And the Minnesota crew comes in, and we hadn't talked to them in the week, and they said, like, we're playing Affinity. What are y'all doing? And we were like, oh, we're on Affinity too. So that made us all feel confident, right?
Yeah, now you're like, all right, we've been confirmed.
Like, yeah, yeah, yes, yeah, like, we've been confirmed. And this Minnesota group,
it's a double-blind test. We've got the same results.
it's Matthias Hunt. He's probably the only... And
was this his Rookie of the Year year?
Yes.
Okay.
This was the only Pro Tour that year that he did not day two. Spoiler alert. Like Kyle Stoll, a couple other Minnesota people, and then our audience at home might know Andres Prost, Baconator on Magic Online, Baconator like 3000. There's some number at the end of his handle, but people know that him as Baconator. Great. He was the one person in this room that was not playing Affinity. And he was like, nah, I'm going to play. He had this Pyromancer Ascension deck. He made the top eight of this Pro Tour because as it turns out, WotC is first pass at a ban list, and it was mainly like cards that had been good in their standard environments, right? So they banned Golgari Grave Troll, they banned Valakut, they banned, you know, they banned Bitter Blossom, you know, with those cards that...
Was Wild the Coddle on the list yet? Was
this it got banned later and then unbanned. It's and I'm trying to remember, like, Dark Depths was banned, and Chrome Mox, and the artifact lands, like, you know, a lot of cards that are still on the ban list now, but they missed a bunch. Mainly, they missed Rite of Flame and, you know, Seething Song and all the blue cantrips. And so what ended up being the best decks were all these busted combo decks. The Storm decks all had, you know, Gitaxian Probe and Preordain and Ponder, and they were busted. They could just turn two you, and they were turn three inconsistently, so they were even faster than we were. And then the one sort of like fair deck, quasi-fair deck, was Splinter Twin, which has like always been the anti-combo combo deck, because you have a bunch of interaction and you can kill as early as turn four while disrupting your opponent. So Splinter Twin and blue control, like blue combo decks, blue-red combo decks, were the best decks of the tournament. The really fast, like Through the Breach Amulet decks were solid. And obviously, like Sam Black had the Infect deck.
Infect deck with Blazing Shoal.
Yeah, with Blazing Shoal.
Yeah,
You know, just another like, busted combo deck that could also just turn to you. Like turn one Glistener Elf or turn one Inkmoth Nexus, and like turn two, you could just be dead.
All right, so the initial list real quick was the five Artifact Lands, Chrome Mox, Dark Depths, Dread Return, Glimpse of Nature, Golgari Grave Troll, Hypergenesis, Mental Misstep, Sensei's Divining Top, Skull Clamp, Jitte, Cloud Post, Eye of Ugin, KCI, Moxobol. Wait, this...
No, you're just reading the current list.
Hold on. This says the initial modern ban list. Huh.
Regardless, it's no surprise that WotC missed some things. They mainly banned like problematic cards from standard and didn't really think, you know, and it's going to be really difficult to just test a brand new format with 10 years of cards, right, and find different synergies. And like Amulet of Vigor is not a card, you know, most people probably knew existed. This is before the true Amulet Titan deck even became a thing. You know, that didn't emerge in modern until 2 years later. So nobody, that's not on anybody's radar. And, you know, obviously like Storm, people know about Storm, but that like Storm hadn't really been a thing in any standard environment. When you thought about Storm decks, you thought about Legacy and Vintage with Dark Ritual and Tendrils of Agony. You know, sure, there was like the mono red deck that Chape and Nassif played at Worlds. That was like 2 years prior to this. But that wasn't going to be an issue in a format this powerful. So no surprise that they missed a bunch of things. And we obviously made the terrible mistake of playing a deck that, you know, was completely unprepared for what people actually brought. I did terribly in this Pro Tour. So I lost to Chapin in round one, who was on Twin, and he beat me in like 10 minutes. This is my second Pro Tour. I lost round one both times very easily. And... we like quickly realize that our deck is really bad, and there were a couple Affinity builds that did well, like Shikara Nakajima I think took ninth with an Affinity build that had Fling and Atog, so it could also just turn three you, like the most all in possible build of Affinity, and we were not that. I registered a single copy of Paradise Mantle. I had Tezzeret Demir Tazaret, Agent of Bolas, in my deck. When people were killing you on turn two, I registered a 4-mana Planeswalker. It was bad. I lost to like elves. I ended up losing. So I lost my first three rounds. And keep in mind, you have to 5-3 to day two back then. So I'm literally like, I'm 0-3. I need to win 5 in a row. But my thought is, just get me to draft. Like, I can 3-0 a draft in this format. I was very good at M12. I'd played a bunch of it. I'd done well in draft at Nationals. I top 64'd a GP earlier that summer in Montreal that was limited. I can 3-0 a draft. And I set up for round 4. And obviously at this point, like, I'm not even playing against the good decks. Like, you know, I'm in the 0-3 bracket. My opponent is Boros. I couldn't even tell you what was in their deck, but this was a deck that had been in the Moto League, so we had played against it, and for whatever reason, we knew that we were bad against it. Like, this was a bad matchup. And I, trying in vain to, like, make this matchup better, sideboarded 2 copies of Phyrexian Crusader.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah. Which is a really good creature to equip the Cranial Plating, by the way.
Yes. I
want to put that out there.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
We go to game 3 in this match, and I mulligan to 4. Just had like 3 completely non-functional hands. And I win on my mulligan to 4 with a Phyrexian Crusader and a Cranial Plating. And all I can think is, like, I'm pumped. Now I'm like, yes, we're going to make this run. I'm going to go 0-3 to 5-0. I'm going to day 2 this Pro Tour. You know, just get me one more round. I'm feeling it, and I can, you know, 3-0 this draft. I can only imagine what my opponent is thinking. Like, they brought a bad deck too. They're 0-3 in the Pro Tour. They're playing a matchup that they probably know is good because we're both playing bad decks that were, you know, relatively known quantities to anybody that was paying attention. And I just have this, like, silver bullet of a sideboard card against them that nobody would, in their right mind, would ever put in an Affinity sideboard.
Yeah, it's just so random, yeah.
Yeah. So I can only imagine what they were thinking. Like, it's just not your day, buddy. I, of course, got trounced in round 5 by, like, I got damnationed. That's all I'm going to say, and lost round 5. You were able to drop from the Pro Tour before the draft and collect your 3 packs. So I did that and took my 3 packs and walked to the other side of the room to go team draft with them for money.
For pride points.
Yes. And I did a team draft. We won the draft. My deck was absolutely busted. I don't know if you remember M12 draft, Tannen, but there was a green, like, pacifism kind of effect, Arachnus Web.
Yep.
And there was the big spider, Arachnus Spinner, 6 yep. mana, 5/7, that could tap to tutor one up, right? And that card was busted as long as you had 1 or 2, you know, webs to go with it. I had 2 copies of Arachnus Spinner and multiple webs. I was the only green drafter in the entire entire table. I just got all the green cards, and I played mono green, and my deck was unbelievable because people didn't think green was good in that format for some reason. It just was, well, like, it was one of those colors where if you're fighting over it, it's bad, but if you're the only one doing it, it's really good. And so people think it's bad because they start, like, you know, everybody's trying different colors early, and so you're always fighting over it, and it doesn't perform. And I realized, like, you know, I realized that. So I would generally force it, especially at, like, higher level tables where people were trying to avoid green. I won a team draft, which is the only thing I won the entire weekend. I'm, like, feeling kind of shit. So I play there's a sealed PTQ the next day, M12 sealed. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. I open Gideon Mind Control, and I'm like, yeah, let's go. And, now go like 3-2 drop in this PTQ. It's sealed, like, and now, you know, feel worse. Another, like, you know, brick of an event. I ended up doing another draft that day, and I thought my deck was really good. And Matthias beat me with, like, the most ridiculous deck I've ever seen. It was this, like, weird ramp deck that had it's a 4-mana artifact, and you pay 4, tap it to Elvish Piper to put a creature from your hand into play. Just some, like, shitty bulk rare. He was just, like, ramping into that, putting, like, Sphinx of Athun onto the battlefield. And I just, like, you know, this is a super aggressive format. So I saw his deck and was like, there's no way you can win. And he's like, well, we'll see. He just, like, easily beats me. But that Sunday, I decide, like, oh, I'll just play, like, a legacy event. I'm doing well with elves. I still got the elves deck on me. I register, and I'm playing it. And I'm, like, X2 finishing out the last round to try to, like, min cash again. And who do I play against but Jarvis Yu, who I have not met before, don't know at this point in my life. But I'm playing Jarvis, and he's playing the Stoneblade deck, which was, like, the deck du jour, the fair blue deck of choice at the time. And it's a great matchup for me. So I'm just crushing him. And normally, like, I just, you know, some a lot of people would have, like, dice or weird things in play to, like, keep track of all their mana and stuff when they're comboing with elves. I didn't need any of that. I could just, you know, I would just announce all my mana floating and everything. And normally I was, like, really crisp with it. But I was just so over this weekend at this point that I lost track at one point. And Jarvis is also kind of over it because we're playing in the 3-2 bracket of this, like, Sunday side event. And clearly none of us, like, we haven't done well. And he just, like, snaps at me, like, you know, you really should, like, keep better track of that, you know, like, in a typical Jarvis-y way. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, yeah, whatever, buddy. Like, I don't really care at this point. I'm crushing you. I min cash my stupid side event and go home. And I just had an abysmal weekend.
And sounds like a real fun one, yeah.
Yeah, at this point, I'm just like, am I just bad? Like, I went to two Pro Tours this year. I scrubbed both of them.
Existential dread enters the chat.
Yeah, I feel like my decks have just been really bad for all of them. And I'm not queued for anything at this point. And I've probably destroyed my Elo over the course of the weekend. Shit, am I getting this right?
You all right there, buddy?
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Before we started the show, Tim and I are obviously, like, you know, talking over some things. I misinformed you when I told you that team events were announced this weekend. Team events were announced at Pro Tour Dark Ascension.
Sure. We'll get to that in just a second.
But we did.
Yeah.
The reason I brought up Elo was to try to smoothly transition into our next topic, which I then completely butchered because sure. I'm great at this.
We'll do that in just a second because I did kind of want to review this. I found the actual list. So
yeah.
Going into this Pro Tour, it was Ancestral Vision, Bitter Blossom, Dread Return, Glimpse of Nature, Grave Troll, Hypergenesis, Jace, Mental Mist Up, Stoneforge Mystic, Valakut, and Sensei's Dividing Top. And then after this one, they added Blazing Shoal, Claw Post, Green Sensei, Ponder, Preordain, and Rite of Flame. So they took all those decks that did really well, and they took a little bit of something from all of them.
Yeah, basically. It was a shit show of a Pro Tour. Like, everybody was just like, this is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, you're just, like, we called it PT Goldfish.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah. The goal was to just have your nut draw when you're on the draw. Like, if you can get the turn 2 kill when you're on the draw, you'll win the match. Otherwise, it's like, I want the die roll. I'll kill you on turn 3. It's like, well, I would have killed you on turn 3 if you didn't kill me. Or you could be playing the twin deck, which of course ended up winning the tournament in Samuel Estrade. But most of the decks that were doing well were just goldfishing you out of sight. And God, trying to play Tezzeret in that format was just embarrassing.
Yeah, so after this, a new set came out. And this one kind of revolutionized quite a bit
in
Magic.
We did get announcements that weekend about Innistrad, which was the set that was going to be released that fall. They previewed Olivia Voldaren. I remember seeing that one, and we were flipping out of how fucked up it was in Limited. We're just like, so it's a 4-mana 3/3 flyer that pings their board and can take anything it pings. Okay. And it got bigger. Like, it just did everything. This was notable for a few reasons. One, Innistrad was a change in the way they design sets. This was the first set where they designed everything top down from a flavor perspective, and they let all the designs guide the flavor. Whereas before, they really most of the sets were known by the mechanics. The mechanics were how you differentiated them, and then they let the designs go from there. So the mechanics are sort of the core of the set. You know, so Onslaught was the morph block and things like that. And then Time Spiral was like the everything block. Ravnica had obviously the different guilds, but each guild had a mechanic. So everything was driven by that. Now you have, we're going to make a gothic horror set, and that's going to be our guiding principle. And the mechanics that we make are going to be subsumed under that principle. So, you know, werewolves are made to feel like werewolves, and then the various mechanics with using the graveyard and all the tribal elements of it. So that was a shift in how they designed sets for the better. And this also introduced double-faced cards for the first time, which were also announced at Pro Tour Philadelphia that summer. And we flipped out as well, saying, this is going to make Limited terrible. I can't believe you're doing this. You're ruining the game, as Magic players always do.
The sky is falling.
Yes, the sky is falling. And, spoiler alert, the Limited format went pretty well for this set.
It went really, really well, actually.
Relatively well received.
When you talk about this, if you told me that, and this happened, I remember people were like, yeah, this one's like a gothic horror set. I was like, I'm going to hate this. this is not my thing. It's not my bag. It ended up just being my favorite set of all time. I think the set is an absolute masterpiece. It's amazing. I remember I probably drafted this set more than any other set in my life. I had many decks that I liked to force. One of the reasons I loved this set and thought it was really good is I remember talking about especially Triple Innistrad, because the way you drafted this was you drafted Innistrad, then you drafted Innistrad and Dark Ascension, and then you drafted Avacyn Restored separate, if I remember right.
Another way they played with it. Avacyn Restored was a completely separate limited format. So Innistrad only played with Dark Ascension.
And one of the biggest things people ask, they're like, what's one of your favorite things about this? Like, why do you like it so much? If you took the entirety of Innistrad, like every single card in it, I think I had every card but one or two in my starting deck at some point in time in this format. Like, it made it into a main deck, which at the time is unheard of. I can remember one of the cards very clearly, Cellar Door, never made it into a starting... I think Ross is looking that card up possibly right now, but I remember the card Cellar Door never made it into a main deck of mine in the set. It was my favorite set ever to draft. I think this is about the time where I qualified for my first invitational on the SCG Tour, because at the time I got to play in one, two, maybe three SCG events a year. I could go to Atlanta, I could go to Dallas, or every now and then they would have one in like the Kentucky, Tennessee area, and I could drive, and all these are about 8 hours, and I can drive to one. And I remember it was the time where they would do Standard Day 1 and Legacy Day 2. I did not have a Legacy deck at the time, so I would play in the Standard Open, and then I'd play in the Draft Opens on Day 2. And I remember I won like three draft opens in a row or something like that. Made the finals of like three in a row. Like, I just could not be stopped in this format. I would just crush people. Also, I was very willing to like force the weird decks in this format. Like, Burning Vengeance to this day is still one of my favorite decks ever.
So fun.
And you have to draft the deck as if you're going to get the card. And then if you don't get the card, your deck is not great. But if you have the card, your deck is awesome.
Yeah.
You can look it up at home. Burning Vengeance. It's like 2 and a red for an enchantment. It's like when you flash back a card. Is it whenever you flash back a card, it deals 2, or do you have to pay something? Like, does it trigger?
It just deals 2 whenever you flash back. Okay. That's what made it good. Like, it just gave it to you for free.
Yeah. And I remember, I still remember to this day, one of the coolest decks I ever drafted. I had a Burning Vengeance deck and an Ishrad. And I had, I think it was 5 creatures in my deck. All the rest of the deck was like spells to help trigger.
And how many of them were Delver of Secrets?
All of them. I had 5 Delvers in my deck.
Nice.
And I remember because, like, you would do the thing where, you know, we'd open our packs, everyone would show their flip card. And I noticed that 2 or 3 people in my right all had Delver of Secrets. And I opened Burning Vengeance and I was like, we're doing it. And I just, like, took Burning Vengeance first pick. And then I took all the Delvers. And then you had cards like, there's this card called, like, I think this might have been when Dark Ascension was in it too. I can't remember. But it was like Reap the Seagraph, like cards like that. And, like, it was like, I think, Mona the Unhallowed or whatever. Like, you had spells that made creatures.
Yeah.
So your creature count could be high enough to, like, play a normal game of Magic. But they were also spells that would flip your Delver Secrets. And then most of the spells had flashback, which triggered your Burning. Like, the decks were just so good. Like, it was so hard to beat them.
This is also my pick for best limited format of all time. There are several limited formats that are very good that don't hold up as well. You know, RGD being chief among them. Original Ravnica Block does not really hold up that well. I don't think IPA holds up as well, although it's still kind of fun nostalgia because there's just so many 2-for-1s.
Yeah, I don't like drinking them either. Anyway,
Cons holds up pretty well, but Innistrad holds up very well. It feels to me like the first time they got the level of aggression in a limited environment really good, really down, because in the pre-Planeswalker era, it was just difficult to be aggressive. So when you were playing, especially in limited with the low power level, it was all card advantage. You're just sitting there, you know, playing a longer game and, you know, trying to set up your 2-for-1s and 3-for-1s and huge bombs. and but you know, as the creature quality gets better in the Lorwyn and beyond after Planeswalkers are released, we start to see a couple formats that are very aggressive. Zendikar was the first one. You know, Goblin Piker was and M12 was the second one, where Goblin Piker was actively a solid playable Magic card. And, you know, random 2-mana 2/1s were still fine in Zendikar as well. You just wanted 2-drops as much as possible. This was a format where you definitely wanted 2-drops. Like, every deck where I had, let's say, like, fewer than 4, I felt pretty bad about. Or if I had to, like, play some bad ones, like Unruly Mob wasn't that good unless your deck had heavy sacrifice elements, which was hard to do. Like, you wanted, like, 6 or 7 2-drops in your decks, but you didn't want 12. And you could play a longer game. You could play with Armored Scob. And, you know, and then you could play, you know, with a little bit of card advantage. So there was a good diversity of tactics and diversity of strategy available in the format. And then, of course, there were a bunch of fun, you know, like, offbeat decks. Obviously, everyone remembers the Spider Summoning deck, which to this point has been, like, a little overrated. Like, it was very good when it was first discovered because the people that were drafting it didn't have to compete for the cards at all. You know, they were just, like, you know, first picking the ones that they thought might not wheel and just wheeling the Dream Twists and all the other weird stuff. When you stopped wheeling it, the deck was a lot harder to come together. But the Burning Man just deck was super fun. It's also a format where it took a while for us to, like, figure it out. I remember when the set was first released, I was drafting a lot of, like, mid-range Demir decks. I was like, yeah, like, Forbidden Alchemy and all the Scobs were my jam. And then you realize, like, how powerful Dark Thicket Wolf was. And,
yeah,
you know, some of the white aggressive elements as well. And how good Silent Departure was. I loved being, like, blue-white.
Silent Departure is one of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah. I also really liked Rakdos. I thought red was generally the weakest color, but Brimstone Volley was just such good reach. So if you were, like, a very aggressive Rakdos deck, you could pretty easily get them into Brimstone Volley range if you had, like, 2 copies of it and finish them off that way. There's just, yeah, it felt like you could really, it was, even though red was the worst, you could still play it. It was a very good color balance, very good, you know, strategy balance.
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
Yeah. I remember this set also having a pretty big effect on Constructed all the way down. Like, Liliana the Veil was printed to this. It was,
yes,
you know,
Snapcaster Mage.
Snapcaster. I was going to get to that. We have Liliana the Veil, a 3-mana Planeswalker that was just absurd on rate. You know, at the time, people were talking about this might be the second best Planeswalker ever printed behind Jace the Mind Sculptor. Past in Flames was printed in this set, along with a couple other, you know, cards that worked out well with it. Snapcaster Mage was a huge one. And then an innocuous common called Delverge Seekers was printed in this set that turned an entire format on its head and made Legacy quite a thing, which we'll talk about, you know, very soon. I remember one of the opens that I went to in Standard, I played the Standard Zombies deck that people hadn't realized was good yet. And I was one of the only people in the room, like, playing it, and I had, like, a very good version of it. And I remember being, like, pretty upset because, like, you know, I drove super far with a bunch of my friends. I started out 0-2 in the Standard event, and it was just 10 rounds. And my friends are like, you gotta keep playing? I'm like, yeah, why not? So I rattle off the 8-0 very easily, I might add. I rattle off the 8-0, like, finish the top 16, you know, get some cash or whatever. Play in the draft over the next day, win that. So I think I, like, 14-0'd or something like that the weekend, like 0-2, 14-0 or something like that. And, you know, we drive home super late or whatever, but because people were playing, like, the Kessig Wolf Run deck was popular here with Primeval Titan.
Yeah, that, like, broke that out a couple weeks into the Standard season.
Yeah, it was really big at states that year. Like, we had state championships that actually mattered at this time.
Yeah.
We had one state championship, I remember, because I lost in the top 8 to a guy named Lyle Alford in the mirror, and he had a better understanding of the mirror than I did, and I got punished for it. And, yeah, it was just awesome.
I also top 8 at states that year.
Yeah. Were you also playing...
No, I played a really cool, it was a deck BBD built, and it was a blue-white mid-range.
The Geist of St. Draft and stuff?
Yeah, it was blue-white mid-range. Did it play? We weren't playing Delver. Yeah, it was like a blue-white mid-range, almost like fish deck. It was playing Snapcaster Mage. It was playing Blight Splicer. And you, like, went up to Gideon. You had some Planeswalkers. You played some Gitaxian Probes. I just loved turning my Snapcaster Mage into a Silvergill Adept. And then you just, like, played some removal and some counter spells. You had, like, Moorland Haunt. It's like a typical mid-range deck with a lot of options and card advantage, but you could also be a little aggressive. I remember it was held, our states was just held at a local store. They were the TO, and they didn't want to spring for like a venue. We got so many people that the bottom tables had to like play on the floor, which I'm sure was against the fire code. And so people were just dropping because they didn't want to play on the floor. I lost round one and then won out to make the top eight, and then ended up losing the top eight. But that deck was super cool and very fun. I won a ridiculous game with I like fell behind to humans and ended up I stabilized by double equipping a spirit token that I made with Moreland Haunt with two Sword of Feast and Famines, the deck plates and swords, and attacking for five, then untapping my lands, making a token with Moreland Haunt, floating mana, extra mana, then untapping my lands again and making another token with the Moreland Haunt and leaving all the rest of my mana up because I had floated the additional cost for the activation, and then being able to interact with multiple blockers after making a 5/5. I think I might have ended up like moving the swords over to make my blockers better. And like that's what fully stabilized me, being able to like use the swords to get multiple Moreland Haunt activations in one turn. That was super cool. But that's whatever. The important part of this fall was the introduction of Planeswalker points. Remember Planeswalker points?
Yeah, because I had the most in my state and it was stupid.
Yeah, so this got announced, and like again, like Magic players, we all poo-pooed it, like complete. They're like, "This is complete nonsense." I was like,
"To be fair, this was complete nonsense. Yeah. It was awful."
Yeah. I didn't like how, like, at this point, I still like I wanted everything to be like super professional. Like, I wanted Magic to be more like chess, and like we had an Elo system like chess. Why do we have to use Planeswalker points where I'm a sorcerer? I just didn't like all of that added onto it. Now I'm mostly indifferent. And so, for those that don't remember, because now Planeswalker points are gone, but when they were first introduced, they were introduced as a way to get to the Pro Tour. So there was going to be, that this following the PTQ season, if you were top 100 in the US, it was top 100. Other countries had different, lines. But if you were top 100, you would qualify for the next Pro Tour. So people just started grinding events. There was so much fraud. I kept hearing about like stores that were running like four FNMs a week, like four FNMs each Friday, but like three of them were fake basically just to get their grinders more points because FNMs were like worth a surprising amount of points. They had a weirdly high multiplier because WotC wanted to incentivize people to play their FNMs. And the like side events at Worlds that winter, that December, which was like right before the end date of the season, had ridiculous multipliers. So there were people like flying there just to play side events all weekend to grind points.
That, yeah.
When it first got announced, I thought like, I play a lot of Magic, like maybe I should go for this. And I was like, no, like other people are going to go to way more events because I still wasn't like flying to GPs and going like the full grinder. I was just playing stuff around me. And so I didn't even think about it. I actually skipped one of the early PTQs that season to go play a vintage event that my friend was hosting. I got to Snapcaster and Ancestor Recall. It was super fun. they unbanned they adjust our unrestricted Factor Fiction right before that tournament, and it was round one. And I'm just playing like blue vintage cards, like blue soup with Snapcaster Mages, and my opponent, I go turn one, like, Ancestral myself, turn two, Snap Ancestral, and my opponent, I, like, play a bunch of Moxen or whatever. My opponent, turn two, is a Factor Fiction with all their fast mana, and I just Spell Pierce it. And I'm just like, dude, what game are you playing, buddy? Like, we have way better cards than this now. This card was restricted in Vintage in 2002, like, before, Mirrodin, when Mishra's Workshop got a bunch of busted additions to it. I wasn't really trying. But I remember being just at my house, and this is around Halloween, it's middle of the week, and I'm just bored. I'm like, yeah, let me check like my Planeswalker point standings. Like, I have not looked at it a single time at this point. We're like halfway through the season or so, and I'm like 90th. I am in the top 100, and I haven't even done. I've gone to like three or four PTQs. I've not top eighted any of them. I'm just like mono like 5/2s. So I'm like shocked. But I'd been playing a ton at my local store, and like that just ground me up on points. But I was just playing because the store had ridiculous, prizes and low entry fees, and they let me use store credit to keep entering tournaments. So I was just free rolling the store to build up my collection. And like, I was playing like a win a box on Monday, a draft on Wednesday, FNM draft on Friday, and sealed on Sunday. I was playing 4 days a week unless I was going to another bigger tournament on the weekend. And so I started thinking like, oh shit, like I should play some more events. I could queue for this Pro Tour. And so I go to like the remaining, you know, PTQs. The car I was with made me leave early despite my protests. Like I told them before the event, I was like, I want to stay for the entire thing. I'm trying to grind points. And I'm like, everybody's dead with like two rounds left. They just refused to let me play two rounds. But all I did was go to like a couple local GPTs. I mean, I didn't even like fly to Grand Prix. I didn't do the Worlds thing. But I just like kept pace and finished like 80th without really trying. So everybody else had this horrible experience with Planeswalker points. Like they were, you know, running themselves ragged to make sure they made it. And I barely tried at all. And I made it easily. So for me, Planeswalker points were great.
Yeah, I just remember like not liking what they were incentivizing, which is like funny because, you know, we kind of touched on it, but not really got into it. Like, you know, I talked about how I took a big step away from the game right after doing well at that Grand Prix. You know, we're talking about a couple sets back now, right? We're talking about Lorwyn and stuff. And I remember, like, after the Grand Prix, I was auto-queued for limited Pro Tours on my rating because, you know, I was, like, top 15 in the world or whatever, which I don't think I was that good. Do you get what I'm saying? My rating is top 15 in the world. And here's what I meant. It was, like, I was incentivized not to play the game. I remember I went to a pre-release. The release was, like, 6 or 7 rounds. It was, like, all day or whatever. I went, I think, 6-1. I lost points on my rating.
Easily.
Yeah, because I lost the maximum anytime I lost. And when I won, I could get 0 points in a round.
You probably got about 4 points for your 6 wins, and you lost 16 for the loss, so you're minus 12.
Yeah, so I'm just getting crushed. So why should I ever play an event at this point? You know what I mean? So like, they were trying to figure, like, this is where Planeswalker points came from. People had been asking for a while if we could fix like the bad part. Here's the thing. For as much shit as Magic gets about the stuff, for this, especially this period of time where social media starts getting big, Twitter is starting to happen, Facebook is really, really big on Magic. There's like,
I made a Facebook account before Pro Tour Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And that was like, my,
There's message boards where WotC employees are very active. There was, replies and articles, replies and stuff. And like, you'd see all this stuff on social media. And I'll say this, Magic was really good at listening to feedback and doing what they could to fix what was problems.
Yeah, they definitely
tried. Happen a lot. They tried a lot. And sometimes they'd be wrong, sometimes they'd be right. And this was definitely a try.
In this case, it was a classic case of overcorrecting. It was like, you want us to stop disincentivizing you from playing? Yeah. We're going to incentivize you to play. It's we don't want to have to play that much.
Yeah, it's like not this way. LB, I want you to play the game, but not this way. But like, you ended up not sticking around for long. It only qualified a few people for the Pro Tour, and then it was gone after that.
They got rid of it after the first season because everyone complained.
He was extremely unhealthy.
I think the biggest issue, even beyond like, because the people that were grinding too hard, like they were an extreme minority. I think the biggest issue was the fraud, where they're just getting people running fake tournaments, basically.
Yeah.
You know, like local stores would just run, you know, a bunch of 8-man FNMs, as many as they could, but they weren't playing the games. They were just letting people sign up, like collecting entry fees, like giving out some amount of prize, and the local store is just like raking in money, and people are just buying Planeswalker points, basically. And you know, everybody would just concede to the person that wanted the points, and you know, you would basically just like buy a box from your local store and get a bunch of points out of it. And so, like that happened a lot. There were a ton of reports of it. So I bet that was the bigger incentive to get rid of it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'm just saying, like, yeah, this was a time where I remember, like, the public outcry actually starting to readily affect what was going on because we're getting social media now. It's certain, you know, you go back 5 or 10 years, it's not as readily available. You're not hearing the masses say things. You're hearing stuff maybe from players at events, you know, maybe people are emailing in, or actually mailing stuff in, but it's not as often or as easy as someone behind their keyboards clicking on something and writing a paragraph.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is around the time that I started making a Twitter account. I can't remember, you know, I made it somewhere in these few years.
And like, I made mine in 2014. So a little bit
later. I'm saying we're getting close to it. Right. And so stuff like that is starting to really affect Magic.
But for me, Planeswalker points was just a free Pro Tour invite. I it was great. So that's how I queued for my third Pro Tour.
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking, like, this is a gift. And they announced even before, like, right as the season ended, they're like, this isn't happening for next season. So I knew, uh-huh. like, this is a one-time, like, gift of a Pro Tour invite that yeah. I was granted. And I told myself, I was like, okay, we're going to make the most of this one. And I thought to myself, like, why, you know, what are some of the reasons? Like, obviously, I could have, like, put in more work. But the reality was, like, I didn't have, a team of people to work with. A lot of my friends that I'd been playing tournaments with over the years were starting to get out of the game at this time from, like, you know, 2011, 2012. And so they weren't playing as much. So even if they wanted to, like, help me jam games, they weren't going to be that helpful, in all honesty. And so I was like, you know what? Like, I need to find people. Uh-huh. So my goal, even beyond, you know, doing well with the Pro Tour, was to network as much as possible at this Pro Tour. And this was Hawaii. It's one of the largest Pro Tours ever. It was like 400-something people.
Was this the one that Kibler won?
Yes, this is the one that Kibler won.
Mm. This is the start of his comeback.
Yeah, this is Pro Tour Dark Ascension. Austin was the first one he top-8ed.
Okay.
Did he top 8? I think he top 8 at Honolulu, then won Austin.
Yeah, it's something along those lines. This is one of the first ones where, you know, Kibler started really cementing his Hall of Fame candidacy. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. It's Pro Tour Dark Ascension. I was very good at Innistrad Draft, but once again, this is right as they're starting to brand the Pro Tours with the set names and hold them very shortly after. So we just didn't
I thought this was a very positive move, by the way.
Yeah. So you just didn't have a lot of time to test limited. And, I found a group of people local to me. There were Massachusetts guys. Two of them were Mass. And then Dan Jordan was from New York.
Good old DJ. Good old Dan Jordan. Yeah.
But I was going to stay with them, the four of them, or the three of them, so the four of us. And we had planned to get in about a week early. They got in. The Saturday before. I think I got in that night, and I saw some friends of mine like that night. And then that Sunday was Super Bowl Sunday, so we took that Sunday off the first day I was in Hawaii. And then we're like, we're going to test, you know, Monday through Thursday. We'll have four hard days. And I had gotten, you know, all the cards that I needed. I was pretty sure I was going to play humans, which was one of like the decks people knew was going to be good. I think it was the most played deck in
Champion
the tournament.
Champion of the Parish had just been printed.
In Innistrad, and the big card from Dark Ascension was Thalia. So
impactful card.
Yeah,
I remember.
I went to my local stores pre-release and like traded for Thalias. I remember.
I went to a Grand Prix in like Orlando and I got picked to do some interview. Like you could still probably find it somewhere. Like I'm in the coverage or whatever, even though I didn't do well. There's like just a picture of me. Like I have like one headphone. Remember back then you'd have like the one headphone in of your, I had like one headphone in on my guess. And they were like, you know, what card are you excited about? And it's like, well, everybody's excited about this or that. This or that. It's like, I think Thalia is going to be very big in like multiple formats. And I just nailed that one. You know, that card's going to be great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I picked Thalia as well. I was like, this card is busted. I played a ton of Vintage. So, like, you know, putting Thorn of Amethyst on a creature, I was like, yeah, that card's going to be really good.
Yeah, I didn't even play those formats. I didn't play Legacy yet. But I remember saying, I was like, this is going to be good in those formats. Like,
yeah.
Like, on the play, like, there's multiple decks that just fold to this card.
Yeah. So we hang out. We watched the Super Bowl. I had a little too much to drink that day.
As one does.
Yeah. But we start testing that the next day, and we're also, you know, we tested a ton in our hotel room. Our hotel had the biggest hot tub I've ever seen. This was like a 30-person hot tub. It was just a pool at the temperature of a hot tub, basically.
Sure.
It was awesome because it was very clear that we're in Waikiki, and we're like half a mile from the beach, but we're very clearly like in a hotel that was built in like the 60s. Before all the big resorts got built near the, like right on the beach.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it was pretty clear that we were in like a hotel that, you know, used to have a much nicer view than it did now, because these built like the modern buildings weren't in the way. And so the hot tub was like, it was outside and it was on like floor 12.
Uh-huh.
So if the buildings weren't in the way, we'd have had an incredible view, but it was still a great hot tub. And we were just, you know, hang out there after a day of testing. And we did this for like multiple days straight. And then as other people were coming in, we started, you know, talking to people. And I was just introducing myself to everyone I could. And, you know, I would watch people. I was watching people draft, talking to people about things. I ended up talking a lot to Ricky Sitter and Michael Hetrick, who were Sip It Holla and Ship It Holla on Magic Online.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly can't remember which one is which. I was talking a lot with them. And when we talked a bit, this is probably like Tuesday or Wednesday. I say, I'm probably playing humans. And Ricky shows me the deck that he's playing. And it is a version of the Gruul deck. You know, the one that had like Strangler Geist and Phyrexian Metamorph and Huntmaster and Sword of War and Peace.
Yeah.
And we play some games and he demolishes me. Like, this deck murders humans. And we're all pretty sure humans is going to be the most played deck. And it seems generally powerful. And I think okay, I love that. I think this deck's great. I'm playing this deck. Except Ricky had a significantly worse version of it that instead of Phyrexia Metamorph, played a Daybreak Ranger. You know, the card that Kibler bought like 400 copies of.
And the card ended up not being very good.
No, it was not. The deck was still good. And, I was still murdering humans with it. I think everybody else played humans. Dan ended up doing quite well with it. Humans was still a fine deck. It did fine. But, I really liked my deck. I didn't get a ton of limited practice in with Dark Ascension, but I talked with a ton of people. I knew the kind of things that had changed. I knew that, the spider spawning deck was not going to be a thing because you couldn't do it in two packs. And this wasn't going to be a thing. I knew that the Gruul trick made Gruul a viable combination because that card was really good.
The +3/+1 with
and
trample
but
flashback.
It had flashback. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That card was was like first pickable. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it was one of the better commons in the new set. Yeah. And Gruul wasn't really a playable color combination in Triple Innistrad,
right.
But now it was.
It didn't work well together. You had to be four drops. Your deck was slow and clunky.
Yeah.
And
so that was a big change. But I ended up. So I'm feeling pretty good going into this event. The best story from the event. The day before, I've locked in my deck. The day before, we're registering, getting everything registered. I'm just trying to talk to everyone I can, people I know, people I don't know. Just make sure people know who I am and I can get into this community, right? Well, there's somebody going around asking anybody they can for illusions cards. So the Delver deck as we know it had just started emerging. A few weeks ago, Charles Gindy had won an SCG in Atlanta with a version that had Invisible Stalker and equipment. Then that addition is as another threat in the deck on top of Delver of Secrets and Geist of Saint Draft, took it to another level. But the Delver deck really grew out of an illusion-based aggro deck that Todd Anderson first played months earlier. But by this point, illusions had been sort of supplanted by these new Delver, straight Delver variants, and they just caught the illusion tribal cards, right? But for whatever reason, there was a group of people that thought the more aggressive versions of this deck were going to be better, maybe better against ramp. I don't really know what their thought process was, but there was a group of pros that wanted to play illusions. And so this guy's walking around asking everybody for illusions cards, and I own most of the deck. And so I think I owned everything but the Lord. I didn't have the Lord, but I had everything else. I had it all on me. And I was like, yeah, I'll loan it to you, even though I've never talked to you before. But I knew who it was. It was Cedric Phillips. So I loaned him the entire deck. He introduced myself to him. And he scrubbed the Pro Tour. He gave me the cards back in the middle of day one. He did not do well.
It's like round five. Here you go, buddy.
Yeah, basically just thanked me and moved on with his day. I'd say that worked out pretty well for me.
That's actually how I met Jim Davis, by the way. Was loading him cards that I had never talked to or knew who he was. And I was just at an event, and somebody a mutual between the two of us was just like, "Yeah, Jim needs this stuff, and I know you have it. I vouch." And I was like, "Okay, here you go." I don't even know if he remembers that. Anyway, continue.
I remember being actively excited to loan Cedric cards, even though I didn't really know him. His reputation was as a bit of an asshole, still kind of is. because he's a loud, outspoken person, and there was the whole Esper Charm fiasco. I've always been on his side of that, by the way.
Who's your target?
So Yeah. So, but I was like, I was just like happy to like, you know, again, like, you know, network.
Make friends,
with people.
Network. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like going out to dinner every night with people and doing that whole thing.
Yeah.
But as for the Pro Tour itself, I started out with a win finally. So I felt good about that. I played against humans. Like, you know, I think I lost game one and I was like, God, not again. Like, this is a good matchup actually. Like, and I just crushed the next two games. So I was like, okay, we started out with a win. Like, let's do this. I ended up 3-2-ing. I pretty quickly realized that like Daybreak Ranger was bad and I just started like siding them out. I was kind of excited that we had Daybreak Rangers when I learned of the like Lingering Souls Delver deck that a lot of CFB was playing. I was like, yeah, like I have Daybreak Ranger against Lingering Souls. I should be great. And it just wasn't even good in that matchup.
Nope.
Yeah. So
the card just wasn't good.
Yeah, it just wasn't a good Magic card. Very good limited.
We had a lot of cards like this as your Magic. You look at it, you're like, this does everything. This looks great. And you play it, you're like, this card sucks.
Well, like we were as like, this is the era where creatures are getting better. Mm-hmm. So like the bar for creatures is getting higher. So we saw creatures that would have easily been over the bar 5 years ago, but the bar was in a different place and we hadn't adjusted mentally yet. But I started 3-2. Now, again, you have to 5-3 today too, not 4-4 like today. So I'm going to the draft. I've got a 2-1, my draft today too. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like I can 2-1. And I'm drafting like, I have like a decent blue-white deck. You know, one of my favorite color pairs. My card quality is fine, but I don't have any, like, premium cards. And then pack three happens, and I get Slayer of the Wicked pick three, which was one of the best uncommons in the set.
And that's what it looked like, Ben Affleck, right? I think that's the Ben Affleck card, new IQ.
Yeah. So I slam the Slayer of the Wicked, and I feel great. I'm like, okay, my deck is good. You know, I should be able to get a 2-1 out of this. And I did. You know, I split the first two, and then so I won my win and in for day two. So I feel pretty good. Like, day two, for the first time, I'm 5-3. I think Dan was, like, 7-1. He was at least 6-2. He did the best out of us, but maybe, like, one other person in the room didn't day two, and another one did, something like that. So, like, we had an okay day. I felt like, you know, my decks were solid. I put up two reasonable records, nothing great. But I'm like, I finally feel like I feel like I belong. You know, I'm competing. I'm doing reasonably well, not great. And I'm, you know, mingling and getting to know people. So I'm doing what I came here to do, right? I'm taking advantage of this opportunity that was afforded to me by Planeswalker points. Day two, you started off with the draft. So we're starting off with it. And you start with the newest set. So we start with Dark Ascension. And I open Falcon Wrath Aristocrat, one of the better rares in the set. Slam it and move on. From that point on, I think my next six picks are all black cards. No, nothing red. So I'm mono black with the Falcon Wrath Aristocrat. And I like decent cards like the 2-mana 2/1 Intimidate Zombie and some other stuff. Maybe a removal spell in there. I'm not sure. And pack seven comes, and there's a Diagraph Captain in it. So in each friendly color pair, there was a Lord for a certain creature type, and they were all blank captain, and Demir's was the zombie lord. You know, Rakdos had Stromkirk, and that was the vampire one, and then obviously Drog Skull Captain for spirits, and so on. And one of the things I learned from, you know, just talking to people over the week, and it was in particular talking with Christian Calcano. I'd watched him draft a couple times, and he talked about, like, how good those lords were. You know, if you could get them and, you know, get the creatures of the appropriate type in, you know, at least like 8 or 10 of them or so, you know, they could be really, really powerful. And so I thought, I was like, I've got a Falcon Wrath Aristocrat. Do I want to commit to a blue card? But I was like, there's nothing else in this pack. Let's just like take the Diagraph Captain and see what happens. Well, pick eight comes, the last pack I see before the wheel, and there's a second Diagraph Captain in it. So I slam that one and I'm like, okay, Falcon Wrath Aristocrat.
We're cooking.
We're no longer friends. Diagraph Captain is new friend. And I settled it to a Demir deck. I'm almost mono black. I think my only other blue cards were a Silent Departure and a Grasp of Phantasms. So, like, you know, additional removal.
Yeah.
And I look at my deck and I'm like, my deck is great. Like, I feel really good about this. Also, one of the things that I was quite good at was reading the table from seeing the double face cards. I'm always betting you. So what you had to do was like reveal your double face card to the table at the beginning of the pack. And then you went along drafting, but they gave you like an extra beat between picks to like look around and see if somebody had taken one, because you had to keep your most recent pick on the top of your stack.
Yeah.
So you could see when the double face cards got taken. And so that gave you a lot of information about what people were drafting. And so I'm tracking all of this while, you know, doing my draft, and I'm getting an idea of like what colors everyone is in, what things I think I'm going to wheel. And I nailed it. Like, I knew exactly what everyone was doing at this table from like midway through pack one. And so I feel really good. I 3-0'd the draft. I remember like it coming, walking back with the walking away from the area, you know, after the third round, and I feel really good. And like, you know, Jerry Thompson like looks over and is like, "Oh, how are you doing?" I was like, "Yeah, my deck was great. I 3-0'd." He's like, "Yeah, good job." And I'm like, you know, keeps it, you know, just in passing. And that's just like another moment I remember from the tournament where like I'm interacting with like known players.
Yeah,
just,
yeah.
I feel like I belong here, right? I would
start having this happen soon as well. Yeah, yeah.
I ended up starting 1-3 in the constructed portion on day two. And so now I'm X6. I'm 9-6 going into the last round. And I play against a guy I didn't know, but it was Joel Larson. I had no idea who he was. He was level 6 at the time. Like he had been putting up some results, but I had no idea.
Were you just like in awe of how beautiful he was?
he was very well coiffed.
Yes, very attractive man.
Yeah. So we sit down and
Swedish Kibler, as a lot of people called him at the time. Yeah.
And then Kibler became known as American Joel Larson.
Yeah, that was really Joel and I would become, for people who don't know, Joel and I would become very good friends over the next few years. You might consider.
People started calling Joel Swedish American Joel Larson.
The meme continued. A thing in and on itself. And believe it or not, he actually credits himself with giving me the in my name.
I didn't know that.
I'll tell you why at some point or whatever. Yeah. It's no real story or anything, but he's the one that's like, because I've always like people have asked where did the come from. I'm like, I don't actually know because it was not me.
Yeah. So we sit down to play the match, and he's playing Delver, which was like, you know, ended up being the best deck in the format. And we're playing, and he has an early Gitaxian Probe in both games. And both times my hand is like kind of mediocre, and he's looking in good position. And both games, I just proceed to play the top card of my deck for like four straight turns.
It's just the perfect card
every time on curve. And he was very salty. He was pretty salty. Like he did just like he gave me like a must be nice, something like that. It wasn't that big of a deal. But I, of course, like I'm not the kind of person to get mad at that. I just kind of laugh at it. I'm like, yes, you are salty. I did top deck you.
You are salty, and you for good reason.
I'm not going to deny it. But
I'm a lucky bitch. Yeah.
But I don't give a shit because this means I finished 10-6, and that was basically the line for cashing.
For getting
basically
something,
if you 10-6, you would probably cash. If you 9-7, you wouldn't. And so this was my first Pro Tour cash. I felt awesome. You know, I get out. I'm like super. I was like as hyped as somebody who top eighted.
Yeah,
because
and rightfully so. This is like the first big step in your career.
Yeah. I remember. So the two mask guys I was staying with are Dustin Taylor and John Kublis, and I see them. You know, and I'm walking up to them. You know, beaming smile, and they're like, "Oh, so you won?" I'm like, "Yeah." Now I'm gonna get me a steak. And I just like went out for like a fancy, expensive steak because I knew I just made $1,000, And so that was that Pro Tour, like, you know, in hindsight, like I went 5-1 in limited and 5-5 in constructed. If I had just put some Metamorphs in my deck, I probably could have done better. But I felt like I had a decent deck in constructed as opposed to a terrible one. And I was, you know, it was my first really good limited performance. And I just felt that was the first Pro Tour where I left the Pro Tour not wondering if I would requalify, like, you know, is this going to be it?
Yeah,
but
you know,
knowing like, okay, I'll be back.
That
like,
you belong, that you can play.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'll be back. Don't worry. So definitely a big tournament for me and a super fun one because I was also in Hawaii. So that was great.
I remember missing qualification for this tournament very close. Like I lost I played like four Innistrad PTQs and I lost the top eight of all of them.
Jesus.
Well, I was very good at the format, so I just needed to, like, just win one, and I couldn't. Ooh, so
that venue.
I also, like, drove, like, 10 hours to one of them, by the way. I drove to, like, rural Arkansas, like mid-Arkansas, like Little Rock or whatever. It's, like, I'm in South Louisiana. That's, like, not South. Like, that drive, there's no normal interstates either. We're driving, like, ghost towns and shit. So I actually need to wrap up the show here because I have some stuff that I've committed to that
we're,
I need to leave
about
for.
An hour and a half. That's a good stopping point. And Estrada is a big event.
We can circle back.
I will say
to like,
one last thing for this tournament, which was also fun. So Sunday of Pro Tours, because they were private events at this point, they'd gotten rid of like the PTQs and side events and stuff. They just had like the rest of the normal tournament area, and you could go in as a player, and they just basically gave you unlimited packs.
Yeah.
It was meant for drafting. You had to walk up with six or eight people, and they would hand you six or eight draft sets. Or four, I guess, if you want to.
It was like
hand
you like your little, like they
had
like
but, rubber but you
bands.
Had to have, you couldn't have one person go up.
Yeah.
Right?
I remember, yeah.
And people ended up taking advantage of it and just like keeping the packs. And WotC was like, we're not going
to
do this anymore.
They
and everybody was mad at those people.
The future. They would like give you a badge and your badge would have a spot that could be marked.
Yes.
And you would get multiple draft sets for free.
Now they just give you like a set amount of swag when you check in and that's it.
Yeah. They just give you the bag and like, here, take this. Yeah.
Basically, like, Sunday was just, you know, side draft day. If you weren't involved, like watching the Pro Tour in the top eight, you were just side drafting all day.
You're hanging out
on the site with free packs and it was super fun. But they had announced the return of team events. Over that weekend, they didn't announce how they were going to be structured. They're like 3-on-3 team events are going to come back. We don't know exactly how they're going to work, and so we, of course, being Magic Boomers, assumed that they were going to bring back Rochester Draft because that's the way that you did team limited, right?
Thankfully, they didn't because that was awful.
Yeah, it was. I did one. It was with Matthias because he was
like
the
one
only
or two, and they're god awful.
Matthias was the only person in our group of six that had done one before, so he sort of ran it. And made sure that like we did it correctly, and we did it. And like, it was like kind of fun. Like, I didn't mind doing it the first time, and you know, because you're thinking about a lot of weird things that you normally don't think about. But after doing it, I was like, this was not worth it. This took forever. Like, we could have done two drafts in this time.
Yep.
But that was a big weekend. So we'll leave it there. I will say our next flashback for me. This is now we're to 2012. This is the year that I start grinding on the SCG tour.
Yeah, this is where we're gonna start really getting into like Magic coverage starts getting big here.
Yeah,
like,
SCG
really
tour
big.
And Magic
it's
coverage. So that's the era
I
we're
getting
into
involved
now.
A little bit, like competitively. I take more breaks, but like we'll have a lot to talk about in specific decks. And it's a lot of fun because like my favorite deck comes up here ever. Like literally, my favorite deck comes out the next set and. I can't wait to talk about it for an hour and a half for us. You're going to have to listen to a lot. So,
okay. Yeah, we'll get you some more camera time or I guess microphone time.
Sure. I get enough camera time as it is. speaking of that, just in case this comes out in time, for anybody listening, I have a gig coming up, not this weekend, but next weekend, the last weekend of the month, I think it's the 30th or the 31st, I'll be doing the coverage for the Arena Championships. And I won't just be doing interviews. I will actually be in the booth for casting. And I'm actually a tiny bit nervous because it's the first time I'm going to be casting with somebody that you mentioned earlier in the show. I'm going to be in the booth with Cedric Phillips for this event.
Well, you shouldn't be nervous at all. Cedric is going to make your job so easy.
Yep. I think I have the expert seat, if I remember correctly, or you know, the color seat for limited. So I need to go draft the set 100,000 times just to make sure I don't make an idiot of myself. But...
oh, no. However will you live just having to draft all day and calling it work?
Yeah, exactly. So... for everybody listening, thanks for listening this week. Check out the Arena Championships if you hear this in time for that. Britt, thanks for all the work behind the scenes and for coming up and saying hi at the HBMO. Awesome. Ross, thanks for all the flashback stuff this week, and we'll see y'all next week.